Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com.
There are ways that we can think about changing our perspective and using our daily rituals of thanks and gratitude to start investigating the land on which we find ourselves.
Raj Patel is the author of the books Stuffed and Starved and The History of the World in Seven Cheap Things. He also has a piece in a book of letters to young farmers. He talks with us today about the problematic concept of owning land. That's coming up on Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young. Harvest Public Media has a story on the loss of farmland in the Midwest. And Chef Daniel Orr has the perfect preparation for that great herald of springtime, asparagus. Stay with us. Alex Chambers starts us off with some news. Hey there, Alex.
Hey, Kate. We've got business news this week. Ag development in coal country, and a revolving door between lobbyists and policymakers at the USDA.
Sounds great.
In eastern Kentucky, a site that was once a source of energy will soon be a source of food. Hydroponic Farms USA plans to invest $44 million to grow 42 acres of greens, tomatoes, and peppers on a former coal mine in Breathitt County, Kentucky. Hydroponic Farms USA spokesman Trevor Terry says the company chose the reclaimed mine site because it is a large, flat area. The hydroponic greenhouse will be the second of its kind in the state of Kentucky. KY Hydro Farm in Benton, Kentucky, grows tomatoes, lettuce, and other produce using renewable fuel sources. Governor Matt Bevin said the agribusiness plan is wonderful news for eastern Kentucky. The company promises it will bring 121 jobs to the economically depressed region. A new report warns that Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue has damaged the USDA by removing protections for small farmers, compromising food safety, and eliminating the agency's rural development mission. Researchers with the Union of Concerned Scientists traced Sonny Perdue's most troubling moves during his political career as governor of Georgia from 2003 to 2011. The report, called Betrayal at the USDA, compares Perdue's past behavior with moves he's made during his tenure at the USDA. Perdue's record in Georgia includes a long list of ethics violations, crony appointments, and passing legislation that he profits from. The report argues that he has continued to use a revolving door to fill leadership positions at the USDA, including former business partners, lobbyists, and agribusiness executives. Notable examples include Kaylee Takach, a former lobbyist for the Corn Refiners Association and Snack Food Association, who was appointed as a key advisor on dietary guidelines after receiving an ethics waiver from the White House. Takach does not have any experience in science, public health, or nutrition. There have also been audacious denials of scientific consensus. Last year, the World Health Organization issued guidelines that recommended ending the use of antibiotics in healthy animals based on widely agreed-upon scientific standards. But the USDA refused to follow these guidelines, insisting they were not in alignment with U.S. policy and not supported by sound science. The report also cites the department's lobbying to undo a ban on the pesticide chlorpyrifos, which has been shown to cause nerve damage in children. The group is calling for Congress to investigate ethics issues and to confirm only qualified scientists or economists in key posts. Thanks to Taylor Killow and Chad Bouchard for those reports.
And once again, thank you, Alex Chambers.
My pleasure, Kate.
Farmland and grazing land has been disappearing across the U.S. over the last few decades. For instance, from 1980 to 2017, Indiana lost over 2 million acres of farmland. That's 13% of the total. To understand how communities are handling this transition, Harvest Public Media looked at areas just outside Des Moines, Iowa, and Kansas City, Missouri, places connected by Interstate 35 and by their agricultural heritage. We begin in Missouri with Erica Hunzinger.
Leave downtown Kansas City, cross the Missouri River, and drive about 10 or 20 miles northeast on Interstate 35. This is an undulating land, crossed by streams, and small-scale farmers tend the land, some of the land.
Working girls, and of course the obligatory rooster.
Linda Hetzel lives on 15 acres and runs Prairie Birthday Farm, growing fruits, vegetables, herbs, and wildflowers that'll end up on plates at restaurants across the Kansas City metro area. She and her husband bought this spot in the 1990s before developers took notice of the area's natural beauty and built a subdivision nearby.
Now, when we moved here, Oakbrook behind us was cattle, probably 160 acres.
Homes are pushing out livestock grazing and cropland in Clay County. And there's a bit of a culture clash, says TJ Berry, the head of the County Economic Development Council.
One of the things you got to realize, you have the difference between the new suburbanites and the old farmers. So a farmer, of course, now there's houses around, you're not going to be out firing a 22 rifle or a gun or so forth.
Officials estimate that by 2040, about 13,000 acres will be developed that hadn't been yet. County Commissioner Luann Ridgway says there's a distinct effect of having almost 40,000 people move in just since 2000.
And once a farm field grows houses, it rarely goes back into farm field production, sadly.
From an economic standpoint, development is good for Clay County. More people, more businesses, more jobs. But some people who live on the outer edge of a metro area want to keep open spaces, well, open. For more on that, we'll jump back in the car and continue north to Iowa, passing through acre after acre of farmland for nearly 170 miles.
I'm Amy Mayer in Dallas County, Iowa, just west of where I-35 comes into Des Moines.
And this is a map you can have.
Dallas County Planner Murray McConnell has driven State Highway 6 to Adel, the county seat, for 26 years.
And now on both sides of Highway 6 between Waukee and Adel, most of that's all been annexed.
McConnell points to a map that shows how urban areas have expanded in the county since 1950, adding 11% of county land to cities. Once a small town, Waukee is now a thriving suburb that is adding a second high school. As housing pushes farther west from Des Moines, McConnell's been struck by how much every wave of new arrivals rankles the previous one.
Everybody wants to freeze the landscape as it was when they arrived.
Sometimes the loudest voices opposing, say, a new housing development are not the farm families whose fields abut the planned backyards, but rather the previous wave of urban transplants. McConnell loses influence over the land once a city annexes it. Development typically follows. Still, there are people moving into remaining rural areas precisely because of the farming potential.
That was row crop 2 years ago.
Almost 5 years ago, Lori and Matthew Wies moved their family of six about 30 miles west from Des Moines to rural Dallas County. They now direct market fruits and vegetables, eggs, and chicken. Like most small producers, their location just outside the urban sprawl is critical to their success.
People, because of the choice that we offer, were willing to drive a little bit farther.
Lori Wies says some customers would prefer to drive on pavement instead of the gravel road to their farm. That occurred to her one day when she was on the phone with a county official.
And so I asked the question, is there a plan to pave? And he said no.
That's fine with these new farmers. It keeps traffic down. But how long they can hold off ever-encroaching growth remains unclear. Development brings more people, putting greater demand on county services, including roads, schools, courts, and law enforcement. But that's tomorrow's story. With Erica Hunzinger, I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Support for Harvest Public Media comes from this station and from the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska, host of April's Conservation and Tourism Conference, Plain Safaris in Kearney, Nebraska. Learn how tourism can save our natural environment and help communities grow. More at go.unl.edu/tourism.
And you can find more Harvest stories at harvestpublicmedia.org. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. Needmoreroasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Raj Patel is an academic, an activist, and the author of Stuffed and Starved, The Value of Nothing, and most recently, The History of the World in Seven Cheap Things. He's also a contributor to the collection Letters to a Young Farmer, released in 2017 by Stone Barns Center for Food and Agriculture. Raj Patel spoke with Earth Eats contributor Megan Betts last year over Skype. They talked about land rights, food sovereignty, the commons, and more.
So I have to say your essay in Letters to a Young Farmer was the most powerful essay for me personally and just for me as a food studies scholar. So could you start by saying what you brought into that essay? What were you thinking? What made you feel like that was the essay you needed to write?
Well, you're very kind, Megan. I mean, I think it's important in this moment in world history for us to be able to take a step back and take the long view, particularly when we're prompted by movements like the actions against the Dakota Access Pipeline, for example. The history of the United States is a history of genocide, and it's often believed that, oh, well, you know, obviously that's very sad, but now all the indigenous people have gone and we might as well do the best with the land as we can. And of course, indigenous people are still alive despite the best efforts of, the federal government and contemporary historians to write them out. And the fights like the one in the Dakota Access Pipeline are a reminder that there's resurgence and power in indigenous people's work and communities that needs to be respected. And at the time I was writing this, I was working with a number of indigenous activists and scholars around issues of food. And it seemed to me that the bridge between land farming and what America used to be before it was settled were ideas that could probably do with being brought out in a way that holds all of us accountable. So that's what I was hoping to do with this with the short letter.
So in the letter, you urge farmers not only to farm, but to unearth the history of colonization, of exploitation in our food systems. So how can farmers or any of those listening go about doing that work?
Part of what I'm hoping is, for myself as much as everyone else, that we can change the way we move in the world to recognize that the practice of understanding what's beneath our feet is a practice we need to remember daily. So that may sound very abstract. For example, if you go to Canada, large parts of Canada, if you're ever in a room where someone's giving a lecture or when someone is just welcoming you to someplace, it is part of the rituals of welcome that one not only welcomes the invited guest, but also thanks the indigenous people on whose land the reception is being held. So it's something that you can build into the way one thinks about oneself and one's place in the world. And there are ways that we can think about changing our perspective and using our daily rituals of thanks and gratitude to start investigating the land on which we find ourselves. You know, I'm starting to think quite a lot about Indigenous people's relationship to the land historically and in a contemporary way. And understanding that can also help us understand the future. So this isn't, you know, basically what I'm not trying to do is guilt trip anyone, because guilt isn't a very productive emotion. But, you know, anger and a certain kind of rage against past injustice, and also an understanding of what needed to be transformed for the injustices to be carried out. Well, that can be helpful, because if you understand how people used to live on the land and the kinds of relationships that people had with nature, we can try and reinvent those. We're not going to reenact them, but we can reinvent them and draw from them as we look to the future.
So that brings me to what I found to be the most powerful part of the essay. So at one point you urge the farmer to honor their deed to the land, but also to, quote, burn it, then bury it. If not that, then at least commit something to flame, privilege perhaps, supremacy, entitlement. So this hints at some of the previous writing you've done on the commons or on commoning. So how do you see the commons and land rights fitting into the local or sustainable food movement?
Well, thank you, Megan. I mean, the idea of the commons was once upon a time an area where people could meet their daily needs for subsistence. Now, today, when people think of the commons, they're like, ah, I know what the commons is. It's the place where the tragedy happens. And people think of the tragedy of the commons, which is a sort of thought experiment from the 1960s. And the tragedy of the commons, if you haven't heard of it before, basically the idea is that, you know, imagine we all live in a village and there's a forest around us and nobody owns this forest. And because nobody owns it, everyone will exploit it. And the tragedy is that with eyes wide open, driven by nothing more than greed and the absence of property rights, because nobody owns it, we will just be as greedy as we like and we'll chop everything down and we will saw off the last branch, knowing full well that it will destroy the world with eyes wide open. And that's tragic. So that's the tragedy of the commons. And the problem is that it never happens, not at that scale, not in the real world. People are very good at being greedy, but people are also very good at being responsible. We are social animals. And so the commons is an example of the way that many civilizations have managed land, which is to say without this idea of private property, but instead through a sort of a way of collectively deciding that we're going to govern it together and that we're going to restrain ourselves when we need to. When you have that collective governance, you think about the land differently. When you think about private property, when you start having these principles of private property, you also start to think about the land differently. And if you see yourself as the sole owner of this land, able to do with it as you will, you're going to take a very different relationship to if you see it as something that owns you. If the land is your mother, for example, then you're going to treat it very differently than if it's something that you own, like you own a can of soda.
So this gets for me at a really critical, essential piece of the conversations that we're having about food these days. So yours is a very different approach. It's a scaling up compared to a lot of the other conversations that we have. So we talk a lot about education of individuals, or improving access for individuals, and that centers a lot on choice. Can you talk about the role of choice in these conversations and the power that comes from transitioning from an individual to a collective perspective?
What a lovely question. I mean, choice is, as a number of social scientists are starting to realize and demonstrate experimentally, an illusion. When you go into a supermarket, for example, you're wandering into a temple where you feel like everything is made for you. But in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. When you go into a supermarket, it's one of the most carefully curated laboratories of human experimentation that we've yet come up with. And the irony is that when you go into a supermarket, although you think everything is made for you, in fact, you have been made for everything in that supermarket. You've been transformed into a sort of a consumer that had to drive to the supermarket to get there, that had to ignore or pay scant attention to the poverty that's right outside the supermarket, that believes that a lot of the processed things that are in these boxes counts as food. But I think one of the greatest illusions about the modern food system is that it's filled with choice. And the more that we can realize that we can be happy without choice and recognize that eating locally and seasonally is a much better way of doing things, even if then we find ourselves with a little bit more kale or rutabaga than we'd like. That recognition that actually, working with the rhythm of the seasons shouldn't be a lifestyle choice, it should just be the way things are, is actually fairly liberating. Because in order for us to have the illusion of choice, to be able to have a wall of 100 different kinds of sugar confection that are children's breakfast cereal, requires such damage to the environment and damage to ourselves, it's worth taking a step back from this idea of saying, well, all we need is individual level education and then people can go out and figure things out. I mean, I think that way of solving the problem of the food system is really to blame the victim. Because when we live in a world where we and our children are shaped from an early age by the advertising claims of the food industry, to be able to de-brainwash ourselves from that kind of that kind of propaganda is going to take a lot of work. And to think that we solve the problem of the food industry's lies by a little bit of intellectual self-defense is to miss the bigger problem. That actually we shouldn't be thinking of defending ourselves, we should be thinking about stopping the attacks. And that means moving away from this world of abundant consumer choice and baubles and trinkets and strange blue food, and instead corralling the food industry's power over us by thinking much more, not in terms of, well, we want this in our food rather than that, and thinking much more about, we want to control this and this and this about our food system, and if food corporations get in the way, then they don't belong in that system.
Raj Patel is a research professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas in Austin. And he's a contributor to the book Letters to a Young Farmer. Megan Betts also interviewed peach farmer and author Mas Masumoto about his essay in the collection. You can find that archived at eartheats.org. Here in the Midwest, asparagus spears are daring to peek their tips above the not-quite-frozen ground, announcing spring in spite of the unseasonably cold temps. Chef Daniel Orr has a delicious recipe for asparagus, a Caesar-style dressing. But this one is vegan.
Ever since I was a little kid, we always had asparagus patch in our front yard. And it was kind of my father, his name was Thomas, but we called him Lefty because he was a baseball pitcher. Old left-hander. So we always had Lefty's asparagus, and I even have, during the season, when I bring it over from the home, we do Lefty's pie, which is a pizza pie with asparagus and brie and a kind of a garlic cream sauce and Parmesan. So it's kind of an homage to my father, and that was his favorite pizza while he was still alive. So asparagus has a place deep in my heart. The asparagus we're using here is called pencil asparagus. You want to have them nice and green. They should be moist at the base. So if you look at the bottom of the asparagus, it should look moist. It shouldn't look dried out. Then if you're wondering how to just find the most tender part, you take the asparagus pencil and you bend it, and it will snap off where it needs to. Easy thing to do. And so we have those now. Just because you've broken these off, these are still fairly tender. I mean, I can eat them, and they're still delicious. But don't throw these away. These can be made into a soup or made into an asparagus sauce. The other thing about asparagus is it cooks different times. So the bottom of the asparagus, the stem part, will take a little bit longer to cook than the top of the asparagus. So if you're a real asparagus aficionado, you will have a special asparagus cooking pot. And it's a tall, narrow pot that you drop the asparagus down in, and the stems cook, and the tips just steam. You can steam it and then chill it down so it holds its color. We call that shocking it. So we have it like a heavily salted water. It should taste kind of like seawater, ocean water. You cook the asparagus in that, and then you shock it in ice water, and then you can use it cold. In the restaurant, we often par cook things, so we will steam it, shock it, and then when we're ready to use it, it will cook in just seconds. It just has to heat through. So that's called blanching, and we do that a lot in the restaurant just to speed up service. Okay, and now we're going to make the dressing. So I've got these raw cashews. And the raw cashews is what's going to make it creamy. Okay, then we're going to add some hemp seed oil. It has kind of a green olive oil. It also kind of looks like pumpkin seed oil if you've used that before. And we're going to add 2 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil. We're going to add some Dijon mustard. And then we're going to add some water to thin out the dressing. And the juice of 1 lemon. Seeds are bitter if they're blended in, so you want to make sure you don't get any seeds in there. And, of course, you can't have Caesar dressing without some garlic. My night guy, Delfino, is the one that has to hand peel all this garlic, so he's a blessing to have around. He's my longest employee and the best garlic peeler I've ever met. And we're going to give it a whiz. I don't think you'll miss the anchovies or the Parmesan cheese. It really has that nice flavor. And the cashews almost give it that kind of crunchy, cheesy texture. See, it has a nice, rich consistency. And it tastes like Caesar dressing.
In keeping with the hemp seed theme, you can gently toast some hemp seeds, if you've got them, and toss them on top for a nice crunch. Check out the recipe at eartheats.org. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. That's it for Earth Eats this week. I'm Kate Young. Thanks for tuning in. I want to thank everyone who makes our show possible, including Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Megan Betts, Annie Corrigan, and Raj Patel. Our executive producer is John Bailey.